Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, we've got Chase Harmer. He's the founder at Wishes that we're going to hear all about. And I think spent 26 or 27 years in fintech and payments and sold his last company for something north of $500 million. I didn't get the real number. But we're going to hear about how he accomplished that and how he's revolutionizing the way that can attract a lot more people to giving and to caring about each other. And I'm actually really excited about the Wishes mission. So let's go way back. So fintech, payments, how'd you get the start?
Fintech. I didn't even know what fintech really was until 2014, I think. You know, it was like, what is this? I mean, it's just really just financial technology, right? And most people don't actually know what that means. But I started in payments when I was 19. And so I got a full track scholarship to Cal Poly, but I dropped out and started a payments company when I was 19 years old with a few thousand bucks. Tried a couple times. And, you know, I think with about $5,000, I turned it into a $40 million a year business. And over like 11 years, I think, something like this. And then I realized Stripe was coming into the market. And so I realized that I needed to start adding value to the ecosystem because they were growing by leaps and bounds. And, you know, I was still doing it the old traditional way, payment processing, right? It's a kind of a boring business, it's a commodity type business. But that's really all that we had because I didn't know anything about building technology, really. I had no idea. And so as a non-tech founder, I thought, well, first, what do? You just got to go to India, right? That's where you like get the engineers. I didn't know anything back then. And so like, you know, I just kind of arbitraged some of the money that I made, wasted a few $100,000 trying to do it in India until I realized I had no idea what I was doing. Then started kind of learning the ropes as I went and turned it into a big company, the next company that I was building technology for. Kind of really started as I was trying to solve, I was really big in the hotel space at the time. And so in the payments business, I had the second largest hotel association in the United States. And I went around the country and I was signing up thousands of hotels. And so I thought, well, hey, listen, if I can eliminate the no-show problem, because that's probably one of the single largest revenue loss items for hotels in general, is when people book a reservation, but they don't show up to the reservation because they have no way to charge it back. Customers usually say, well, I called, I did this, I did that. And the hotelier can't, he can't get that money back from the client if they charge it back because they didn't show up and they can claim that they called or whatever. So we created this product that would tie consumers to the transaction, you know, when they made a reservation, and that turned into building a gateway, building a payment facilitator company, building a card issuing platform, you know, pivoting 20 million times to like try to serve the market, and really learning a lot of hard lessons at a very, very high level. And they kind of set me up to do what we're doing now. Had I not spent the last 7 years building technology, creating patents and doing all kinds of stuff in virtual credit card issuing, I would have never known to do what we're doing now for Wishes and really do it in one eighth of the time, you know, that it took me to build the first platform. It was just a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money, a lot of stakes. But I escaped out of there and was able to turn it into something and build this company. So,
yeah. So let's talk about what was going on at that point. You're doing $40 million a year already, and you realize, like, what's going on is not going to cut it. What was going through your mind right then? What did that feel like? And how did you deal with that productively?
You know, I think that I've always wanted to make something that mattered, you know, and I really knew at the heart of that is that to make something meaningful and valuable, there had to be technology involved. And I think my hesitation, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs' hesitations is, well, like, I don't know how to build technology. Like, where do I even start, you know? And, there is no real book like on this, you know, and there's, what engineers do you hire? Like, I think really what it was for me is I knew that I was going to slowly lose that revenue over time. So I could have kept making money for a long time, and it would have slowly dwindled away as I lost market share to Stripe and some of the other competitors, because every year my clients were calling me to reduce their fees. And if you're just selling on fees alone, and every year they're reducing your fees, you know, it's like a race to zero. Like, you really, like, how much more can you whittle it down? Like, you know, at a certain point. And then certainly, and there's like no loyalty, right? So they'll just switch over anything. So in Stripe at the time, and I keep using this example because they were not the cheapest on the market. They were expensive solution. But somehow they were getting all these clients. And what I found out was that you make it easy to board clients and you add a little bit of value. At their time, they were just payment processing in the very beginning, and it was just, it made it super easy. What they fixed initially was the process of actually boarding a merchant services account. And that really was the game changer at that time. And I knew that if I was gonna compete against them, then I had to make it easy and also add additional value to even be an option. And so, I took my money and put it into what I thought was the next great thing. And that ended up costing me a lot more than $2 million. I put $2 million in. It ended up costing me a lot more. And I think it's just really generally, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. There is no book for it. You know, PayPal, they can go in a room and say, hey guys, we have this idea. Here's like $100 million, you know, and then they blow through the $100 million and it's gone. You know, when you're an entrepreneur and you have like X amount of dollars and you can't just like throw people in a room and be like, you know, figure it out. Like, we're going to do this. And it's like, all of a sudden the money's toast and you're like, oh my God, like the dream is over. So, I wanted to build something meaningful, like long-term. And I think just I'm driven by that, more like making a product real. Even though I didn't know how to make it, I just felt like that's how you make it, you know? That's how you do it. That's how you can like change the game. So that was kind of my ambition at the time.
So. Oh, that's awesome. So did you end up taking investors before the exit, or did you bootstrap?
I bootstrapped the first few $1 million, and then until finally we had something that was working, and then we raised close to $30 million after that. The company was acquired by a travel company, and you know, in a mixture of cash and stock. And so, it was they're in a kind of different area, but because of the fact our market really became like, when we came into the e-commerce space, what I saw was, so we went from like this fraud prevention company to like building gateways and do this, because I was like, man, we have to be everything, you know, like Stripe's everything, we got to be everything, you got to be like all in one solution, you know. So sometimes I felt like I was building staircases into the ceiling, like the Winchester Mystery House, you know. It's like, you didn't even know, our team didn't even know what they were doing sometimes, you know. There's just so much going on all the time. But really where like we got traction in the market was in e-commerce. Most of the online e-commerce store owners were really using their debit card to run their business. And, you know, when you're running, using your debit card for your advertising dollars, you're not making any cash back. What we saw there was an opportunity. And the reason why is not because they don't like want to use a cash back. It's because most people that start businesses don't have like tons of money, right? And they don't have like a huge arsenal of cash laying around. And so they don't have huge credit lines where they can make these cash back. So what we did is we built a process to attach their debit cards to a virtual credit card, which essentially was making the purchases for their online advertising and then was giving the 2% cash back to the online e-commerce marketers, and then we're rolling it in with payment processing and all these things. And so that kind of that started to gain traction, and that really got us, you know, in the market where people were utilizing the product and whatnot. And that's real kind of like how we grew it. That was like the unique selling proposition, is this 2% cash back. And even today, there's no one else that's doing that. You know, I think Stripe actually charges like 2% to use their cards. So, it was kind of like the reverse model. And I knew that they would have to completely change their business model to compete in that space. And so we sucked up a lot of e-commerce opportunities and marketplaces that that were out there doing, which everyone spends money on. You can't actually live online if you're not spending dollars online trying to acquire traffic, trying to acquire customers. So, you know, that was kind of the hit, you know, and that's what kind of made us take off. So,
yeah. So what's the time frame between raising $30 million and selling for the 500 plus?
That took about 2 years after. So it was a couple of years after. So, you know, fintech, the great thing about fintech is that if you can solve a real problem and you have traction, it becomes a pretty valuable entity. And I think similar to what we're solving in the charitable giving space now, you know, we're not even revenue yet, but we're already valued at like $20 million, right? And so I think that's what I love about fintech is that, and this is why I think pretty much if you look at every app that's on your phone, there's a fintech component that's involved in making that a valuable company. And a lot of these guys, they'll outsource a lot of that stuff initially until they have enough revenue to start trying to build these parts themselves. And eventually a lot of these guys do that. But I think that's really, really how all these guys grow. And so it took a couple of years after the $30 million in a long-winded way to have an exit. That was done in 2022. So
amazing. Well, so let's do this. Let's take a detour to Wishes and then come back and finish the rest of the profit pay story.
Sure.
How do you describe the problem that Wishes solves?
Well, so I was approaching it from a donor's perspective first. Every donor that you talk to probably is going, well, what's going to admin? What's going to impact? You know, there's a lot of huge charities out there that, you know, have nothing but Mercedes-Benz in the parking lot. You wonder, like, and every grocery store is asking you for a dollar, right? Where does that dollar go, first of all? Like, that's what started irritating me is that, like, and then you see a commercial probably 3 months later, 4 months later, and then the grocery store is claiming, we donated $40 million to blah, blah. It's like, no, you didn't. All the customers that gave a dollar donated. And guess who gets the tax write-off, by the way? So they look like the hero. They get the tax write-off. And the donors don't even understand what the impact was. So I think you either have time or you have money, right? So if you have time, like, you can actually see the labor of, like, the contribution that you're making. You're making that direct impact. Your hands are doing the work, whatever, you're involved, right? But if you have money and you're donating to causes, you'd like to understand. I mean, people give to people, right? So the macro problem that we're solving is transparency. So then I thought, well, you know, I'd spent the last 7 years pioneering virtual credit card technology before Apple Pay was Apple Pay. And people are used to seeing virtual credit cards on their phone, making a purchase with their iPhone or their Google phone device at a grocery store. They probably don't, when you say virtual credit cards, they probably don't understand that what they have in their phone is a virtual credit card, right? But that's what it is. And essentially, I have a bunch of patents in that space. And I'll give this example so it kind of makes sense, right? So when I say every purchase was a sale, if you talk about the only people that were doing virtual credit card issuing back in the old days was travel companies. So if you look at a booking.com or expedia.com, those types of companies, they're not the hotel, they're not the airline, right? So how do, when a customer makes a purchase at Expedia, how do they actually book that ticket in real time? The answer is, when people purchase that Expedia, they actually create a virtual credit card and then they pay the hotel, and then there's arbitrage on both sides. So I became fascinated with this idea of purchasing a purchase. Every purchase was a sale and arbitraging the credit card interchange in between. And I was like, well, listen, like, the biggest problem that can't be solved in charitable giving, which all charities know that they have to show impact. If you're going to ask me for $100, you have to come back and ask me for more money later. And they're not able to do that. So we essentially use the same model. We have a 501c3 on the front side, and then we have our fintech where all of our investors sit on the backside, which is kind of the platform, right? So all dollars go in through the 501c. So Number one, all charitable donations through our crowdfunded platform are tax deductible, whether that's to an individual, charity, or a cause. All the other platforms in the market, GoFundMes, all these other ones, none of them are tax deductible, right? So the only thing that's tax deductible is if you donate to a charity directly through those platforms. So, and then we turn those into virtual credit cards. We issue those directly into the charity or to the cause of the crisis. So we can actually fund up to 10 times faster than the market. So if you look at like GoFundMe, it takes 10 days, Instagram's 45 days, Facebook's 90 days. We can do it in one day. And there's most instances where we could do it in the same day. And it's all fully transparent for the donor. So they can always understand where that money's going. And if you look at the last little sauce that we put into the platform is rewarding the donor, right? I thought, well, this would be cool because I do credit card arbitrage all the time. And I was like, well, you know what would be cool is if like the donors were able to get cash back and rewards for those donations, because there is no cash back category for giving, right? And I was like, so if we can actually, our nonprofit owns a lot of other companies and they're all specifically categorized for the merchant categories on your credit card. So think about where do you actually get cash back? Restaurants, groceries, rideshare, hotels, airlines. So think about Maui, right? Maui fires. You had people that needed a hotel to stay at. They needed groceries for their family. They needed an airline ticket out of there, right? You can actually donate directly to an airline category or a hotel category, and your credit card company will see it as a hotel purchase. So you'll actually get the cash back and rewards from your own credit card. You get the tax deductibility instantly inside of the platform. We issue those into which is our shopping portal. Our shopping portal houses thousands of the biggest box retailers in the United States. So like everywhere that you could possibly shop, Expedia, Booking.com, Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, Costco, Sam's Club, all of them, right? So they can instantly use that money in the shopping portal and get whatever they need.
Yeah, so let's go through an example. So in addition to my commercial real estate fund at Greystoke Investments and our media company, Greystoke Networks, for the last 14 years, I've run a charity called Child Rescue Association that combats child trafficking and exploitation.
Sure.
Okay. So let's say that we're supporting an aftercare facility that would really like some hotel stays for trafficking victims right when they get out or something like this.
Yeah.
Right? Help me walk through some donor wants to donate $1,000 to us through Wishes. Help me understand the money goes in and then the rewards come back out.
Yeah, so whoever's making the donation would obviously get those rewards, right? So if you, in this instance, if people are donating.
Okay, my mom. Let's say my mom wants to give me $1,000, okay?
Right.
So she uses her personal credit card to give $1,000 to you in the first place?
Two Wishes, yeah. Through Wishes. So
two Wishes.
So you would, so think about it from the Wisher perspective. So you would actually be putting up the story inside of Wishes. Like, so you say, hey, this is the story. We're doing this for the traffic victims, blah, blah, right? She would actually donate towards your story and she would get credit. She would donate towards the hotel category. So she would get her cash back and rewards. She'd get the tax deductible receipt, which is all managed through our platform. And that card would be issued directly to that story, where you can either issue that directly to the charity, or you could actually buy a book of rooms through Expedia or booking.com or whatever. But you can only utilize it at like a travel, like our hotel. Like you can't, so like think about it like a gas card almost, right? You can't use a gas card inside of Macy's, right? You just can't. So that also helps the individual fundraisers. So the biggest problem that the crowdfunding platforms in the market have today is they have no control after they give the money to the bank account. It's like no holds barred. You know, they get that money, they're off doing whatever it is that they're doing, and who knows what they're doing. I mean, there's Netflix specials about what they do on like with once they get funded on GoFundMe. So the reality is, really proactive transaction monitoring tools in place where we actually can see those transactions in real time. And if someone's trying to abuse or misuse the system, we can just cancel a card and then that's it, you know? Or we can pause a card and be like, hey, listen, don't do that type of thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, I have a lot more questions about this because I, of course, know a lot of other nonprofit leaders. And there is this thing of like we had a Jake Gyllenhaal's dad on the show. He produced a new documentary called Uncharitable with my good friend Lindsay Hadley. She executive produced. And it's based on like the best, you know, the highest view TED Talk of all time about like, how can we reshape the customer mind to be more focused on how much impact was made per dollar, not how many expenses per dollar? Because mm-hmm. it's like, you know, what if somebody spent nothing on overhead, but they didn't do any good? Who cares, right? Like that's not the ultimate metric, is how much went to overhead versus how much went to the program. The ultimate metric is, for every dollar that went to the program, how much impact was made, right? Mm-hmm. But like you said, those news stories are so salacious. I mean, the people pay to make an entire Netflix story about it. So when you look at the low donor confidence, especially for new donors, I mean, people like Charity Water have done things like, okay, so the people who know us and trust us can give to this fund that will pay the overhead and pay like so you can actually afford good people to do your work, because you can like you try running an organization on only volunteers, you only get so far, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But then like all the people who don't know us and love us and trust us, you give to this pile and 100% of it goes straight to digging the well in Africa, right? Mm-hmm. And what I think is interesting is, I'm just thinking about my friends who run nonprofits and stuff, like the ability to work with you guys for that low trust introduction, right? Where somebody like, they don't know you well enough to feel confident that you're gonna use overhead dollars correctly. Mm-hmm. And so they want to give only to the program, mm-hmm. you know, working with you to be able to say like, for this introduction to the donors, start to the story and like building the trust of like, they give first, it only goes to programming.
Right.
I don't know if maybe I'm misunderstanding it though.
No, you are. And I think one of the things that we also do for nonprofits though, is we actually let them to create the story. So if they are, if they choose to connect their bank account, they can raise for admin dollars, but just like Charity Water, they have to disclose what they're actually spending the money on. So like it can be part of their overall raise, like, hey, we're also raising for admin. We are a real company. We have real operational costs, right? Just like Charity Water does. And I think, but then here's like the mission. This is what we're also doing. Hey, we need HVAC unit. We need this or this, right? Whatever it is, right? So you can actually see those dollars at work. And then you can also to the admin, which we actually deliver right to the nonprofit's bank account. So we kind of grade our nonprofits through transparency, also through the platform. So so we're kind of on both sides.
Yeah. Okay. So I have a bunch more questions about this, but let's finish the profit pay story first. So So let's just do this. Like, you know, there's a whole bunch of people listening today, myself included, who would like to turn 30 million into 500 million in 24 months. Okay. So what's a $500 million success secret for us?
I mean, you know, I think I felt like a lot of the time I learned everything the hard way. So I felt like it would have gone a lot. It would have taken less than 7 years to do it had I not made, you know, so many wrong moves. But I think part of the process of learning and building something special is you have to go through that process. It's like you can't really do it right from the start easy unless you've done it before at a high level and made those mistakes. So I think you have to have the right engineers in place. Part of the problem why it took 7 years was, you know, I didn't know what engineers to have. I was like, oh, just engineers? Perfect. Like I got I had a front end engineer first. You know, I didn't even know what was a DevOps. I don't even know what a DevOps is. And then back end, front end. I didn't even know what the hell. Like, and then you have to document it. Like, so after like 5 years, I was like, what do you mean document? Like, we have to document this? No wonder it takes 2 months for new people to figure out like what to do here.
To clarify on that, was it like 7 years of bootstrapping before the raise or 7 years?
It was 7 years like total, right? So 7 years total.
Four years bootstrap, then the, or 5 years bootstrap, then the 2 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Post-funded, so
it was done in 2022. I launched it in 2014. So, yeah, 7 years, about was the 6 years. I don't know how to count. So it's like close to 7 years, basically. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it was just having to redo a lot, you know? So, and it's just really knowing how to build, get the right people and do the right things. And that seems like obvious, but it's not actually.
You know, I just have to say, I have a lot of respect for people like you who have like the guts and the like accountability to start by bootstrapping.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple multi-billion dollar success stories out here in Utah, Pluralsight and Qualtrics. And like, I think Qualtrics bootstrapped for like 14 years before they took money or something. Okay. Yeah. And there's like a discipline on like what we're doing needs to work when you're bootstrapping. Right. And they work out so much. I mean, A, that it's so much more profitable that in the end, you're not giving away all of your equity to get the money. Right. But think about how, you and I both know so many folks who are undisciplined who are like, I can't possibly quit my job without a few million dollars in the account. Right. Or like, yeah. You know, they're like, they don't start on anything until after the money's raised. And then they burn through all of the first investor's money and then come to this point of like, oh, are we actually going to get serious now? Or are we going to say, I'm sorry?
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of them just say, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
right.
I'm sorry.
When it's your cash.
Yeah.
Like every dollar is precious. And there's like this, there's this accountability feed loop and it's so stressful and it's annoying and stuff. But, look at this. I mean, how awesome is fundraising when it's like, oh, we worked out all the crappy part ourselves. Do you want to get in? Do you want to get in for the scaling? But it's more profitable for you. And anyways, I don't know if you feel differently or similar.
You know, I think I have a weird concept about money. Like, so for me, it's like it's all or nothing all the time. Like it's either I'm going to be dead broke or extremely wealthy. There is no in between. Like there is no in between. Like if I have money in my pocket and I have an idea, like there's nothing that will stop me from pursuing it. Like I will literally like use all the money I have and then figure out the next month after that. You know? And so I think that's kind of just like how I roll. It's just how I'm like built, which is random. And I just have a weird concept about money, even when it was my own.
No, listen, you know,
yeah.
I have all these people on the show who've grown companies into the hundreds of millions or billions. And then I have, you know, like pro athletes, you know, from action sports world or stand-up comedians like Jay Chandrasekhar, you know, now he's like a famous movie star and director and stuff, but he's also still a stand-up comedian 25 years later, right? And like, you know, these hardcore special ops guys, like the tier one guys at like the classified levels of special ops, like there's a big personality similarity of like going for broke. Like, you know, 97% of the world wants to just stay here in the valley and keep farming, right? And then like, biologically, there's like 3% that are like, I wonder what's on the other side of that mountain, you know? Yeah. And so all I'm saying is you probably could have been Jason Bourne. I'm just putting that out there.
I feel like I could have. I feel like I could.
Yeah. So
anything else.
Let's keep going on this though. So thinking about, you know, the business press is full of you shoulds, right? And everybody has an opinion, but so few people have experience. What's another one of the principles for you that you feel like made all the difference of this $500 million plus sale?
Process. I mean, process is everything. So, and I say that because the first time that we launched our marketing campaigns, like we had so many, we weren't prepared for what happened after. Like there was just so much influx of new traffic and we realized like, we don't have any process built. Like, you know, we just had no process. And so I think if you look at any great company, any big company, they all have processes in place that are duplicatable, replicatable, and everybody knows them. And, you know, when it usually in the founders, you know, we have everything inside of our head. And, you know, it was a lot of that initially until, you know, I had Walter O'Brien as a mentor for a couple of years. You know, he's one of the smartest guys in the world. I don't know if you've ever interviewed that guy, but he's pretty legit. And so he taught me a lot about to go slow to go fast type of thing. And so I think, you know, I was always rushing. Like when you have a startup and there's just a million things going on, you got fires, probably more problems than anything else. And I think you fail more than anything else. And I think a lot of the failures that beat you down, you know, I came from a $40 million like winning streak, you know, and then I went into like the biggest slump of my life, you know, for like 6 years, just like losing. And so it's just, you know, and finally you win, but it's like, man, like it just humbles you a lot. So I think process is everything, and go to slow to go fast is probably one of the biggest lessons that I learned. Because then I use that on the engineering side too. I was like, well, we got to go faster. I had 120 engineers working for me at one point, and which doesn't seem a lot when you compare it to like big companies, but I mean, we were not like a huge company. Like this is like a lot of chaos. And I mean, you know, I was just like, pour on the engineers. But you know, when engineers were taking 2 months to get acclimated because you had no code documented, not the greatest of solutions. And so we needed to back up, document all the code and get new engineers in. That's kind of like, you know, yeah.
So. Yeah. I'm interested during those rough times, especially when you've won in the past, right? Yeah. I think about this, like my personal net worth has had like the severe roller coaster, right? Yeah. At different times, like really severe, okay? And I'm interested when it's really sucking.
Yeah.
What do you tell yourself? Like what helped you during the rough times when it's like rough and then it stays rough and then it stays rough and then it stays rough?
Yeah.
What are you telling yourself at that point that worked for you?
You know, I just think whenever like there's just roadblocks and everything. If I see daylight, like I feel like there's a chance. I'm like the eternal optimist. So like I never give up. And like, I think the only person that could say it's over is you. Like the fat lady can't ever get on the stage unless you give her the microphone, say, sing your tunes, you know? And so it's like really, I think it comes down to sheer will. You know, and, you know, perseverance. And it's just really kind of like, if you got to figure out a way. I think all entrepreneurs and founders that have been successful at some point, they figured it out. Like, you know, a lot of stories, like they were just about to go broke, like they just about to lose everything. And then somehow magically, like they figured it out. They got some sort of solution. Some guy came in, you know, they had a like, God moment, you know, it happens. But it's the founder that kind of creates those opportunities and the CEO, whatever. And so I feel like, all great founders, they figure it out. And, you know, as long as there's some daylight that you can cling on to, then there's a chance, you know?
Yeah. You know, I think for me, when I've had like really prolonged downs, right? Like my faith, reading like Stoicism books, like I love Ryan Holiday's book, The Obstacle is the Way. Just like watching YouTube videos of my heroes, the Warren Buffetts of the world, and just watching their speeches and like listening to other, you know, podcasts of like somebody who did it and went through the crap too and ended up succeeding in the end. Those are some of the ways that like I've tried to do it. And like, especially the it's not what happens to you, it's what you do about it kind of stoicism stuff like has helped me framing wise. What were some of yours? Like, were there any, like, did you have any business heroes you looked up to? Did you have any go-to books? Did you, what got you through the crappy times?
You know, I think that the book Delivering Happiness by Tony Hsieh, it like really, I can relate to that story a lot. You know, it's just, you know, it's like, he's always on the cusp of failure. And then like, you know, he just makes it. And so there's a lot of that, you know, but I think the guy that I listen to probably the most is Jordan Peterson. I listen to a lot of Jordan Peterson. I can't get enough of Jordan Peterson. Like, I can dig it all day. Like, he's just, you know, he just brings out like some real, like thoughtful, think, you know, it really makes you think, you know? And so, there's
personal
a lot
of responsibility.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, is there anybody better at like, like helping you go like, oh, I guess I could take personal responsibility for my situation.
Yeah. He's the reason why I make my bed, I swear.
Oh, that's so great. I want to go back to process though, because if you know, if that was your answer, when I'm saying like, what's one of the most important principles, you're saying process. Yeah. Give me an example. Do you like agile? Do you do like lean operational excellence? Did you just make up your own? Or do you like the checklist manifesto? Like who were your process heroes or what methodologies ended up working for you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we use Asana and Jira and all those things, but I think, you know, really what, cause you can write it down, but unless you actually train people and go through it, it's really just, it's not duplicatable. So we really built our own systems to do it because I didn't really know. And then we have ticketing systems and all this that come into the platform and tell us what to do, when to do it, when things break, if we're not aware of that. And then we also try to get feedback from our platform users, right? So the platform users will always find things that you're just not even looking for, right? Because we see it from a different side and you try to put yourself in the user's shoes, but the reality is like, you're not really a user. You built it for the user, right? So you can't really like see all the kinks that they see because maybe you're looking at things differently. Yeah. So.
Okay. So yeah. I'm a total believer. I'm loving everything you're saying, but what I would love is some granular details on, I mean, it's hard enough to invent the structure that you think, okay, I think this is the process we'd follow. And then you have like the never ending work of having enough accountability, having enough follow-up, having enough accountability to have people actually use it. And like building a culture where it's like, this is how it works at this, you know, if you work with us, this is how it goes. And then like when people get a lot off track, like not letting it slide and getting it back on track. Like, tell me about the indoctrination, you know what I mean? Like this is how it's going
to
be around
here. No, it has to start from the beginning. And unfortunately, like in ProfPay, like, you know, we had so many employees and then we're like, okay, we're going to do this now. It's like, everyone's like, nah, you know, it's like, it is hard to enforce. You know, so like everything like we had to do in reverse that company, like, you know, rebuild the foundation, you know, retrain employees, and then you have to get them ingrained into the system. That's super hard. And then you're going to lose people just because they're like, well, dude, I'm not doing it. I've been doing it this way forever. So really the best way to do it is to do it right from the beginning. So one of the mistakes that I made when I did ProfPay is I thought a lot of those things weren't necessary. It's like, dude, we just build product. You know, we're going to do this. We're going to, you know, do all this stuff. But what's probably most important as you're doing that is to set those rules and set those things in place and also set those processes in place. Because if it's there from the beginning and all the employees from ground floor are doing that and then they're training the other people, then everybody is in line. And if you do it in reverse, it just becomes almost impossible and everyone's resentful for sure.
So let's talk about this though. You know how like there's just cultural shift and there's, you get new employees and you get big personalities over here and you get, you know, there's those people who are better at getting away with stuff than other employees. Yep. Talk to me about like what was happening weekly, monthly, yearly to like get on track to, you know, to get everybody up to standard, to verify that processes are being followed. Like give me something like super tactical granular that people listening today can like do tomorrow at their company.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that we implemented was governance. And so we had one employee for each department inside of a monthly Senate meeting. It was a weekly Senate meeting. So we can actually understand the concerns from each department. And then we'd actually address them every week. That was like super helpful. But again, like, you know, when you have departments that are siloed and they don't talk to each other, and then you don't have those rule sets in the place in the beginning, it becomes super hard. So the key about governance is you have to have the agenda planned out before, and it's got to be pretty strategic every single time. And you can't just go in there and be like, hey guys, what's the problems over here? It's like, no, you actually got to like have a plan. And we had a whole entire roadmap every single week about the governance. And then we had departmental meetings. I mean, sometimes the meetings were so much. Like, I'm really not a huge fan of meetings just to have a meeting. You know, it's like, it's pointless. But unfortunately for me as the visionary, like, I had to have duplicatable meetings because people just don't understand my brain a lot of times. And so, like, you have to have someone that breaks that down. But I think the most important thing that allowed us to actually build kind of consistency and really manage that accountability was those weekly Senate meetings. We called it the Senate. But that was our governance. And we'd have, you know, the customer success there. We have, you know, all the executives there. We'd have all the departments that were in. They'd all have a voice in that meeting.
And so how many employees did you have at that time, and how long would a Senate meeting take each week?
Well, we kept it to an hour. And the reason why we did that is because we had a very strict agenda. And so sometimes it would go to like an hour and a half, but every department had a voice. And we'd talk about, like, you know, there was like various things that we talked about for each department, but those were also the accountability checks and where we talked to but it's just one person from each department. So one key person from each department, and then they would report down to their management. And, you know, that's how we kept accountability on track. And we obviously manage the employees from the management, manages up to the Senate, and then the Senate kind of manages down that way. But the last question I think was, I forgot, was you said something, you asked me something else.
Oh, don't worry. Let's do one more. Give me another $500 million. Like, this is a principle I couldn't have done it without. Like, what's like the Chase Harmer gospel, you know?
The Chase Harmer gospel. I think, you know, one of the things that I learned is, like, you know, you really just have to have one person that can break you down. So this is more of a founder thing, is that what I realized took me a long time to really get is when you're trying to preach to engineers, first of all, they're like a different species of human most of the time. For me, like, I'm like the Jason Bourne, they're like something else. And so, like, you know, and then I'm super excited and, you know, so they'll all like nod and do this stuff, but then you have, then you just don't get it done, or they bring it back and they try to figure it out because you told them to build a triangle, but they're building it like a square and they have to deliver you a square. So I think you have to have that really key person that can break it down, break you down to actually get into the engineers. And that saved me years of time with the newest project. What I didn't have the last one.
Visionary engineer translator, exactly. Implementer type of person.
You have to have that. And it's like, but they have to understand you too. That's the thing. So, like, you know, they say, hey, you got to have this project manager. It's like, okay, project manager. Boom, let's just get a project manager. It was like, well, dude, if they can't break you down and they're the ones that are talking to the engineers, good luck, dude. You know, so you really have to have someone that really understands you and asks you questions like, hey, I don't understand this. Because a lot of people will just be yes mans, you know, and they'll be like, yeah, well, okay, totally get it. And then it's like, but do you actually get it? Repeat it back to me. Like, tell me you understand this. You know, like, and I think I really didn't do that until, like, we realized we just had so much backlog inside of the platform. And, you know, and I think when you have so many employees, and this goes back to the process thing, is you have employees that hide, you know, back in there. It's like, you know, you're paying them a bunch of money, but, like, you're like, oh yeah, where's Jimmy? You know, like, oh, Jimmy, like, his son's sick today. It's like, dude, I haven't seen Jimmy for a while. Like, what the fuck is he doing? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, Jimmy's like, he's taking you for a ride is what Jimmy's doing, you know, but, you know, so you have a lot of that. And then, but then you also have, I think what you also have is that when you build that resentment, it goes back to trying to implement rules later. When you build that resentment, or employees start having that resentment for you, then you get off a phone, you get off a call, and you're like, yeah, dude, I nailed that call. Like, they totally understand this. And then they're having another call. And they're like, and she's like the one boycotting you. Like, you know, like, this isn't good. Like, you know, we can't do this. It's like, you know, but you don't even realize that's happening, right? And so, and that can actually create, and then those people become like cancers in that organization, like in the siloed organization. And then you really just don't get crap done. And so, you know, that those were kind of the things that were happening too, which we had to weed out. But, like, if you don't know what's happening, and a lot of it just comes from you trying to build a process too late, you know, and because people will resent the fact that you're trying to do this, and then they boycott you, you know, behind your back, you know, because they're like, yeah, totally, Chase. Yeah, totally get this, bro. Yeah, let's go. And then you're like, dude, I nailed that call. And they're like behind you having another call, telling everyone, like, dude, we can't, this isn't possible. Like, you can't do this. And I'm like, dude, what? You know, but you don't find out until later. And they're like, dude, Chase, they're talking about you this call. And I'm like, dude, it's crazy. So I think, you know, there was some of that stuff going on. And I think that those were some of the biggest lessons that I learned, is like, you got to really cement that, even though it seems unnecessary in the beginning to, like, format this process. You're like, dude, I'm formatting this process for something that doesn't exist. We're building a product, bro. Like, there's nothing here. You know, it's like, no, but if you don't do it, like, you will pay the consequences later, you know? And, you know, because the time that when it comes time to launch, you're like, dude, we spent a year and a half building this product. We need to get to market. Like, now we got to build process. No, like, it's easy to do it if, like, when you're doing it, it doesn't seem like as much work. But when you build the product, and then you have to go back and do process, it's basically just like having a bunch of engineers build code, and then you're like, hey guys, go back and do 5 years of documentation now. You're like, but Jimmy's gone. He built it on Ruby is on Rails. You know, it's like Ruby on Rails, like what part is done? Like, God, like, oh my God. Like, you know, this is the disaster that you have to deal with, you know? Oh my God. So, you know, that's the life though. You know, those are the lessons you learn.
I'm getting your passion for process and early and consistent. Let's switch gears. Let's talk about Wishes. So, yeah. I mean, congrats on an absolutely stunning exit, and congrats on now using these skills for good to help your fellow man around here.
Yeah.
When you think about what you're really trying to get done at Wishes, what do you feel like is maybe one of the biggest lessons from your previous successes that you're bringing with you?
The compliance side, I think, especially since we're dealing with, you know, we have two separate boards, two separate executive teams, one for the 501c, one for the fintech, and keeping them church and state, and actually managing the compliance was a heavy lift this time. And I think that also had to do with the fact that a lot of crypto companies went down in the last year, you know, and they, a lot of the banks that were backing the fintech, I mean, that really kind of operate in, you know, are the big players in that space. They all got kind of hurt. And so like they're under scrutiny. So, but we, it was a heavy lift, and I think we took it super serious, where last time it was more like relaxed, like it wasn't as intense. But we realize now it's like with consumer confidence, where it's at, with donor confidence, where it's at, like this has to be, we have to nail this. And every dollar and cent's got to be accounted for. And if we're saying there's no fees for anything on the platform, then that's what it's got to be, you know? And so we got to make sure that that all happens. And,
and what's the website if people want to get on the wait list for the app?
Yeah, it's wishes.inc. And if you go onto that page, you'll see a couple different personas. There's one for donors, nonprofits, and a wisher. So if you fall into any of those categories, just press on those buttons and then you can get onto the wait list and we'll put you in the queue. As soon as we're ready to go live, we're going live on Apple first. We will keep you in the loop and get you guys in that first batch of people on the platform. So
I'm interested from a marketing perspective. What are you finding are the most effective ways to connect with the right people who can help get you the Wishes message out? And like, what's effective for you?
Well, what we're seeing is that we did some preliminary testing and we signed up thousands of nonprofits. Nonprofits realized that this is going to be a good, great way for them to raise funds and bring awareness to their causes, but also donors. Donors are super excited about this platform. And, you know, if you ask any donor about, like, this is really why I built the platform, really, is like I wanted to be that trust engine that donors can always count on to always understand where the money goes and how that money's being spent, whether it's going to admin or the mission. I think we're really kind of spreading the word organically, but we feel we also built this as a private label. So the way that this expands in reality is these nonprofits, they load up all their donors. And then the moment that donor wants to reach out to another charity or cause or crisis or there's another disaster, they'll use Wishes to send money, and then they become a Wishes opportunity as well. But we feel like, you know, the wishers having a great experience will also post on social media, and we've kind of gamified the internal aspect of it as well. So we've made it pretty cool for both donors and wishers to really kind of reap the rewards of being on the platform. And we hope that through social media, it organically, and also through influencers. Sorry. So we're also running big influencer campaigns with like NBA players and some of the more well-known influencers to run fundraising stories, which will kind of just like, you know, so as soon as we get those guys on the platform, they'll bring their own audience who all download the app and grow it that way too.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, congrats on all the success.
Well, thank you, man. It's been fun. Yeah. You know, it's been a journey.
Yeah. If people want to follow you or keep up to date? Is the website the best place? Social? What's best?
Yeah, I mean, so reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, Chase Harmer at LinkedIn. You know, I'm also on Facebook, but, you know, more of a LinkedIn guy. So, yeah, if you'd like to connect with me directly, send me a message or get me at my email, chase@wishes.inc.
I love it. Well, thanks for making time for this.
Hey, appreciate you, Jess. It's been great.